Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We have a jam-packed hour for you this week, featuring school safety, how the scramble for workers is affecting state services, the first in an election season series defining those down-ballot offices, the search for a new business model for news media, new music from Tiffany Williams, and another in our series exploring the international communities of the region through music. When you visit the website of the Kentucky Center for School Safety, that's kycss.org, and click on School Safety Issues, you find a laundry list of concerns. They include bullying, cyberbullying, parent aggression, and school violence. These are some of the issues on the radar of State School Safety Marshal Ben Wilcox. Education contributor Gil Hunter caught up with Marshal Wilcox for an update on school safety and security in Kentucky.
Marshal Wilcox, thank you for talking with me today.
Absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you, sir.
As you well know, school safety is an issue on the front of everybody's mind as students and teachers across Kentucky and around the nation have returned to school for the new school year. What do you say to parents, students, teachers who wonder about the safety of our schools in Kentucky?
Well, I'd like to reassure them that, you know, schools are still a very, very safe place. And, you know, there's been several legislative things that have come up in the past few years, of course, with this passing the School Safety and Resiliency Act of 2019, that really put an emphasis on school safety and not only just locking up of schools, but also working on the hardware, is what we like to call it, in our schools. And what's important about that is it's comprehensive legislation that really goes to the heart of school safety. And it's making everybody responsible for school safety within our schools. And so I tell parents and kids that schools are a very safe place, and of course they're as safe as we make them as well. Mm-hmm. As parents and students, we always need to look out for safety within our own schools, and you know, it being a whole group effort really makes schools safer. And of course, our report will be coming out very soon that we do every year. The Office of the State School Security Marshal does every year that follows the mandates of the School Safety and Resiliency Act. And our numbers look really, really good. Just like they did last year, they even look better this year.
Awesome. Can you talk about your role as marshal? That's how I introduced you there. And the work of the marshal's office in establishing and maintaining goals related to school safety?
Absolutely. What we do is we have a risk assessment that was mandated for us to create by law, and we go over that risk assessment and make sure that all the mandates that were put forth in the School Safety and Resiliency Act are being followed. And we're not just kind of the hammer looking for the nail. We really are, even though compliance officers, we're also a resource for our schools. So if we go in and find that a school needs to update their emergency plan, or if they're having some trouble getting their doors locked and things of that nature, then we can be a resource for them so they can get to that 100% compliance, as that's what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. We work very closely with the Kentucky Center for School Safety and John Akers' office, which is located on EKU's campus. They're kind of the catch-all for school safety. So if we run into training that needs to be done for the schools, we always resource out Kentucky Center for School Safety, and we have that collaboration together to make sure that all the mandates are followed. Also, our office does training for schools and school staff. We've been all over the state this summer going over the mandates, reminding folks of why we do what we do, reminding folks why we need to keep doors locked, and that's kind of what our office does. And what's really great about it is it's a regional office, so our regional compliance officers are spread all over the state, so they have that local connection to the schools that they go in and do assessments on.
Schools have made a lot of changes over the years, and really maybe even since last year. We had a very public national tragedy late last year. How have things changed?
Well, I think that, you know, going back from when you and I were in school, is that if you go by what we call hardware and heartware, let's talk about hardware first. Mm-hmm. You know, before it was, you know, not as hard to get into a school. You know, you walk in the front door, walk right into office and start speaking to the gatekeeper there or the secretary that was there. And, you know, now we've learned that we need to lock down our schools, that we need to keep our exterior doors closed. We need to have a single point of access to people. We need to vet people as they come in to make sure that they actually need to be in that school or what their mindset is when they're coming into that school. And I think a lot of the change is what we call the hardware. And that's looking at our mental well-being of our students, looking at the mental well-being of our staff. And that's, you know, the School Safety and Resiliency Act provides for both of those. They provide for that hardware of making sure that we are keeping bad people out, and that hardware of making sure that our students have that mental well-being with counselors, with assistance from other mental health professional staff. And so, you know, I never thought about those things when I was in high school.
Right,
I never
thought
about a door that needed to be open or locked, or, mm-hmm. you know, an interior door needed to be closed and locked, or how many counselors we had. I didn't even know my counselor when I was in high school. And I think that's a huge change now for the better, because you're getting everybody together, and everybody's got a history, and everybody's got a past, and everybody's got a home, and they all bring it to school. And that's where we've got our specialized units, as I like to call them, that help those kids out. And I think that's going to be the future of school safety. We can get it locked down as tight as we can, but we got to be able to help the inside of those kids when they get there. And I think that's where the future is going to be going, is more mental health, more counseling, more avenues for kids that really need some help.
Yeah, and you know, it's probably beyond your scope here, but that hardware piece that is so important and that you're well aware of and have talked about, that can't all be delivered by classroom teachers. They need help in doing this kind of thing. I've talked to your wife before, guidance counselor there in Madison County Schools, and she's talked about kind of being a point of reference and teachers kind of triaging and then sending kids to her. Teachers need help. We know that. Administrators need help to keep schools safe. This is going to take a widespread effort. And I think the reason I say all that is because when you and I were in school, and I'm probably quite a bit older than you, but when we're in school, we might have been afraid of being bullied, but those kids brought fists maybe, and they're not stopping there now.
All right. And you're absolutely right. And the fact that we have a majority of different people to go to in our school, the law calls for that there be at least one trusted adult for every kid that's in that school. And I think that's so important, because that one trusted adult for a kid, that kid may not have a trusted adult in a teacher, or a trusted adult in a counselor, or a trusted adult in a principal, but they may make a relationship with a custodian, with a bus driver, with a cafeteria worker, with an SRO, as long as there's someone there that can help relate. And that's what teachers are so great at, is they can say, okay, I may not be having the best relationship, but I know that this child has a relationship with Officer so-and-so, or has this relationship with the counselor, and be able, like you said, to triage that to get them the help they need. And, you know, that's what we're looking for, and that's what the kids are looking for, is a trusted adult to talk to. So we just got to make sure and utilize everybody that's in our building.
So I've heard you talk kind of a couple different ways, I guess, about what the next generation of school safety might look like. Can you describe it briefly, and then maybe tell me about places where you're already seeing some of that being implemented?
Well, you know, we're seeing a lot of the School Safety and Resiliency Act calls for, you know, locking of doors. They call for a certain type of entrance, electronic locking door in the entrance of the building, cameras on the front of the building. There's all kinds of different technologies that go into school safety. The biggest one is this, just using it. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the future, is that we can put all the neat locks and cameras and bell doors, alarms, and vestibules and everything else. The future is going to be making sure that we have a commitment to using those things. We've walked into schools before where I'm like, why are you propping these, you know, $10,000 doors that have alarms open on them? Shut them. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. But I also see that it's going to be, that village raising a child. That's what it's going to have to be, everybody getting involved in school safety. We know that there has been critical incidents that there has been leakage from, where when I say leakage, someone said something and said, hey, so-and-so is planning this. I think that school safety also has to do with the ability for kids to feel like they can be heard, for kids to be able to report things. You know, we have a tip line in the state of Kentucky that is phenomenal, and making sure and getting that information out to the kids that, and they feel comfortable saying, you know what, I heard some things today at school that made me uncomfortable. I'm going to call and say something to it. Because you can put as many police officers if you want in a school. You can lock the doors tighter than a drum. But if we're not getting good information about what's happening in kids' lives, a school's not going to be safe. So the future needs to be really focused on that.
Yeah, and when you talk about villages raising children, that doesn't happen just within a school. So this is a community effort. This is
absolutely,
this is
yes.
strengthening families. This is strengthening communities.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of those things, you know, a school, as you well know in your career, you know, how much time does a child spend in a school compared to spending at home? We have got to get that home life to where they feel comfortable and feel safe and working with our parents. Parents ask me all the time, well, what about my school? Well, have you called and asked? Ask them what they're doing. Call and ask what safety measures are out there. You know, talk to your teachers. See what's happening in your counselor's corner. You know, see what's happening in at school. Taking that step forward to being part of what's going on makes all the difference in the world.
We're all in this together. I think you've made that case compellingly, and we all know it, but we have to act on it. And I thank you for doing the part that you're doing in that direction. I've been talking with Ben Wilcox, Kentucky School Safety Marshal. Marshal Wilcox, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
This is Gil Hunter, Interim Dean of the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences at EKU for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Jason Bailey joins us. Jason is founder and executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, and we're coming to him for some perspective on competition between private sector employers, such as big retailers, and state and local government employers. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So in April of 2020, when we were struggling to comprehend what a pandemic would mean for the economy, all signs were pointing to a big decline in tax revenue collected by the state and a commensurate decline in the state's abilities to provide vital services. Now, Kentucky finds itself enjoying the second highest budget surplus in state history, more than $1 billion. So legislators in Frankfort are now talking about cutting state income tax rates. In your view, does this surplus justify tax cuts, or should tax rates remain the same and this enormous surplus be invested in improving services and infrastructure?
Yeah, we shouldn't be making permanent tax cuts using temporary budget surpluses. You know, we have a surplus that's largely the result of the pandemic aid that was sent during COVID in the form of stimulus checks and expanded unemployment benefits and other aid that has resulted in very strong economic growth over the last couple of years. And that is creating a surplus. And along with, we are also seeing high inflation right now. And that's also resulting in greater tax revenues because when you buy something, it costs a little more. So when you pay that 6% sales tax, it's a little bit more tax revenue as well. So those factors aren't expected to continue. The pandemic aid is going away. Inflation is expected to cool. And so our revenues will not be as strong as they are now in the future. But under legislation that General Assembly passed last year, they're looking at permanent reductions in the income tax rate, which is our largest source of revenue. We get nearly half of state revenue from the income tax. So when we make permanent reductions, we're giving away a lot of money that we will need and that we've shown that we've need over time to pay for our public schools, to pay for our infrastructure and health care and other basic needs.
I've heard the saying, borrowing trouble from the future doesn't deplete the supply, and that seems to apply here. In the meantime, there is what you call a crisis level shortage of workers in state government. Talk to us about that.
Well, what's happened over time is as the state has not had enough in revenue and has actually been forced to make budget cuts in the years before this current surplus, what we saw is that real degradation in the quality of jobs in the public sector. We didn't see any raises for state employees for 10 out of 12 years. And starting in 2014, state employees and public employees of all kinds no longer receive pensions, traditional pension plans, which were a really powerful tool for attracting and retaining people to work as a social worker or an environmental regulator or another important public sector job. And so since that time, because of the budget cuts, there's been a reduction in positions through attrition. And now there's just a very difficult time in attracting people to those jobs. The pay is low. The benefits aren't what they used to be. And so people are finding that there are private sector options that pay more. So there are a huge number of openings in state government. State government is the only sector of the economy that is continuing to see job losses, even in the strongest economy that we've seen in a very long time, because people don't want to work there. The pay is not enough. The respect is not there. That's a real shame because those jobs are so important to our community.
Well, like so many sectors of the economy, retail has been in a constant scramble to attract employees. And we hear of at least one big retailer in the area who's offering very competitive entry-level pay at levels institutions like public universities, like this one, cannot match. Does your analysis of the situation confirm that?
It does. I mean, what we're seeing is that some of those low-wage employers, like in retail and in restaurants, have had to finally increase their wages. They have been increasing them for a very long time just to attract the employees that they need. And we've had what some people call the great reshuffling over the last couple of years. Others call it the great resignation, but it's more accurately a reshuffling because people are quitting jobs not to not work, but to take better jobs. And unfortunately, in some of our most important jobs, like at public universities, those are the ones they're leaving to take a job in the service sector. You know, markets have to respond when, you know, wages aren't adequate to attract the workforce they need. But in the public sector, it requires the government appropriate the dollars for them to be able to raise wages. And the state, the legislature, just hasn't been willing to do that in most of the recent years. And so it's created a real problem and a real backlog for vital services. If you look at the child welfare crisis, where we've been understaffed with social workers, if you look at just a wide range of things where we just don't have enough employees to carry out services that people rely on.
Well, what's your perception of these claims that nobody wants to work and that all employers are struggling to find workers? Is that really the case?
It's not. In fact, what we've seen is record number of jobs being filled. Our job growth is very strong right now in terms of how many people are taking on new jobs. It's just the choice of which jobs they fill. Employers who pay well, provide good benefits, provide good working conditions, aren't having trouble attracting and retaining workers. Those who are employers that insist on and have gotten used to a period over the last few decades where they don't have to pay a living wage. They don't have to provide good benefits. There have always been, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, an ample number of people who were desperate for any job and would come knocking on their door. That's not the case at the moment because we have a very strong economy. And so workers have a little more leverage, and they're making choices. They're looking for something better. And so employers who recognize that and understand that and are upgrading job quality are seeing much better ability to attract workers than those who continue to insist on underpaying their workforce.
Now, am I right that state workers did get a pay raise in the budget that was passed by the 2022 General Assembly?
The state workers finally did get a pay raise. They got an 8% pay raise. Now, again, that was after over a decade of no raise at all.
Right.
However, teachers and school employees did not get a raise in the state budget this time around. So the legislature sort of split who received a raise and who did not.
Well, what are the real practical consequences to the public of a diminished state workforce?
We rely on public services in ways that we don't always recognize how important they are. And this became very clear to many, many Kentuckians during COVID when they lost their jobs and they had to get unemployment benefits. The office that provides unemployment benefits had been so understaffed and underpaid for many years prior to COVID that they didn't have the capacity they needed to process these benefits. And so you had long lines, people calling on the phone, calling day after day, trying to get their benefits and having to wait and having to struggle at a time when they needed the help the most. And it was simply a function of underfunded and neglected basic state capacity. We never know when crises are going to hit. I tell you, in Kentucky, they've been hitting pretty often lately. And so, you know, we have to have those services in place to be able to respond when we need them. And when we don't, things happen like with unemployment, and we all lose out.
All right. That's Jason Bailey, founder and executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Thank you so much, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How often have you gone to vote and been puzzled by some of the offices on the ballot? Introducing an election season weekly feature defining these elected positions, so when November 8th rolls around and you find yourself scanning that ballot, you'll be fully informed about these local elected positions that are almost always overshadowed by state and national politics. A series is hosted by CivicLex Director Richard Young. First up, what is a constable?
A constable is an elected peace officer. The position dates back to Kentucky's first General Assembly, the legislative branch of the Commonwealth, which created the position in 1792. Along with sheriffs and watchmen, constables served as one of the primary law enforcement mechanisms until the creation of modern police departments. Constables are legally allowed to carry firearms, have the ability to make arrests, and can conduct traffic stops. But their primary duties are usually delivering warrants, traffic tickets, summons, subpoenas, and eviction notices, among other civil documents. Instead of receiving salary pay, constables are paid per service. So, if they serve a court summons, they are paid for that individual service. Constables do not receive the training that police officers do. They are also not first responders, so they don't have the authority to respond to emergencies unless they receive government permission. In 2022, the Kentucky Constable Association filed a lawsuit against the state legislature after they passed 2022's House Bill 239, which removed many policing powers for constables elected for the first time after January 2023, unless they receive certification for professional training. Under this bill, constables would be required to pay for this training out of pocket, which costs around $15,000. Constables that are already in office would not have to complete that certification. There are three elected constables in Fayette County that serve three representative districts. Fayette County elects constables every 2 years. This year, in 2022, there is only one candidate running for constable in each district: Andrea Walker for District 1, Jim McKenzie for District 2, and incumbent Edward Sparks for District 3. Make sure to register to vote or check that your registration is up to date by October 11, 2022, to participate in the upcoming election. You can check your registration status at govoteky.com. Want to learn more about the positions on the ballot in Fayette County? Head on over to lex.vote to learn more. If you want more information on all things local government, you can check out our website at civiclex.org. There, you can subscribe to our CivicLex weekly newsletter and follow us on social media. From CivicLex for Eastern Standard, I'm Richard Young.
Wait, what did he say constables do? If you missed something, we're building a library of these CivicLex primers on down ballot offices, and you can find these features as they air on our site at esweku.org. Click on the Civics tab and you'll find it there. Also, a direct link to LexVote 2022 that Richard mentioned. Coming up after the break, professional journalism of the vetted and verified variety is the lifeblood of American democracy, and it's in trouble.
The for-profit model that sustained these newspapers has basically collapsed, and how are we going to address the interim over the next several years as we try to develop new either for-profit, non-profit, or public funding models?
Singer-songwriter Tiffany Williams out with a new album titled All Those Days of Drinking Dust.
It's about like what it's like to grow up in the shadow of coal mining, basically.
And continuing our exploration of the music of the international communities of Central and Eastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops also support veterans in the communities they serve through an honor flight to Washington, D.C. More about how co-ops are making a difference at honorflightky.org. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Over the past, let's say, couple of decades, the United States has lost more than 2,500 newspapers, and maybe half or more of newspaper readers and journalists have also vanished. It's of great concern to Penny Abernathy, who has been an executive with the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, was the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina, and is now a visiting professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Dr. Abernathy is the author of News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive? She's also the lead co-author of The Strategic Digital Media Entrepreneur, which explores emerging media business models. Penny Abernathy, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Well, thank you, and please call me Penny.
I will do that. And your recent study, News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, documents the state of local journalism, what is at stake for our democracy, and the possibility of reviving the local news landscape. And I'd like to explore each of these topics, if I could, beginning with the state of local news. What's your assessment?
Well, I think it's very concerning. For so long, we focused on what would happen if we lost our national news organizations. By and large, national news organizations have found their footing in a digital world. What concerns me the most is that where the loss has been greatest has been in small and mid-sized communities. These are the very communities that have relied on local newspapers for almost 200 years to both provide the news that helps them make residents make everyday decisions, as well as the news that binds them binds us all together, you know, that shows us how we're related to someone we might not know in our own county or in another part of the state and share the same problems and issues so we can come together and solve them. So if we lose the local newspaper, which has been the prime, if not sole source, for many communities, the tens of thousands of communities spread across this vast country of ours, we're missing a key part of the system that makes our democracy work and the system that holds our society together.
Well, from the congressional hearings about January 6th, we're getting this very sobering reminder of the fragile nature of American democracy. And there's been quite a lot of reporting about something of an anti-democracy movement on state and local levels. Does this raise red flags for you about this general withering of local journalism?
Well, I think what it raises two points. One, that if you look at what was supposed to be the great equalizer in our democracy, which was the internet, you know, studies have shown that 90 to 95% of the news that makes it on the internet, either in a search or on your social media, is nationally related, and national politics are very polarized. So in the absence of local news, and let's face it, who's on the school board, who's elected to your county commissioner, or your town council is going to have more impact on your everyday life than who is ultimately elected to Congress or even to the presidency. So we've become very focused on national politics to the detriment of looking in what had traditionally been a more nonpartisan way on the issues that affect us on a daily life. So, I mean, I think in the absence of in the vacuum that has occurred, in the absence of local news in many communities, people turn to the internet, and what they get is a version of what you should feel because of the politics that are on cable television or the nightly news or in national newspapers.
Well, again, from your study, you note that extensive research has established that the loss of local news has significant political, social, and economic implications for our democracy and our society, for that matter. Yet, according to the Pew Research Center, almost three-quarters of the general public remains unaware of the dire economic situation now confronting local news organizations. Are we, as a society, kind of fiddling while Rome burns? What's behind that disconnect?
Let me say, the Pew study was done in 2018. I've done five reports now, beginning in 2016. The report you just referenced was 2020. And I think what I've noticed is that there has been a real awakening in the last 2 or 3 years across multiple disciplines in academia. So political scientists as well as economists are really focusing in on what the loss of local news means for our democracy as well as our society. And we've gotten politicians as high as Congress working together to try to say, what can we do to make sure this vital function that newspapers have served over a 200-year period continue in some form, whether it's print, whether it's digital, or whether it's broadcast. In some way, we've got to ensure that. So while I think the general public may, by and large, be unaware of how dire the situation is for many news organizations, I'm very heartened that we've begun to get the attention of people who can begin to craft solutions to all of this. I've been heartened by the response of the League of Women Voters, for instance, in several states, who've come together to kind of document what it means to lose news. And I think what that says is we really need to continue to push the notion of what does the loss of local news means. I'm also heartened by the research that has been done over the last 2 or 3 years. There's several major pieces of research that have been done. And what that research has shown is that when you lose a local newspaper, voter participation goes way down because people don't know even who's running for Congress. Corruption increases in both small businesses in that area and in the in government in the area. And as a result, we as taxpayers end up paying more because there's no one looking over, providing transparency, or even serving the watchdog function that we looked to in the past. There are also studies that have shown in the absence of that, we get a flow of misinformation about what actually is going on. And, I mean, you look to COVID to see how vitally important it was to know exactly whether it was even safe to go out to the grocery store during periods of time. So we really need the information that comes locally that tells us how to live our everyday lives as well as plan for the future.
Well, we know that journalism doesn't just happen. It has to be paid for. People work. And so that means keeping the lights on and everything else that's involved on the business side. Are some meaningful media business models beginning to emerge that we ought to be paying attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what in this latest report that was just done at Northwestern that I authored, what we're really saying is that what we have emerging in the U.S. is a journalism divide, that we have areas where there have been quite substantial progress made in new news in different ways and covering underserved communities. But our research also shows that the areas that are most likely to lose a newspaper or a news outlet and not have a replacement are the very areas that need it the most. They're the economically struggling, traditionally underserved communities. So that means that we really have to rethink the for-profit, the nonprofit, as well as maybe even public funding for some of these areas. So to back up the answer to your question, yes, there are new and exciting and innovative business models being developed. What we've got to do is get entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and politicians and policymakers focusing on the areas where we have not had that happen because the for-profit model that sustained these newspapers has basically collapsed. And how are we going to address the interim over the next several years as we try to develop new either for-profit, nonprofit, or public funding models to help all of us in this country get the information and news that we need?
We have a generation now of young adults who have come of age as digital natives, and many even older generations have migrated from traditional newsprint to digital media. Is it time for us as an industry to make peace with this transition and move on? Is newsprint really... I can have a difficult time even saying this, but is newsprint dead?
Let me answer your question a different way. Not only do we have a journalism divide, we have a digital divide in this country. And it's very easy if you are in an interconnected city where everybody has access to broadband, who can afford to pay the amount to access broadband, mm-hmm. to forget that we're a very vast country and that the minute you get outside the city or even in many of the inner city neighborhoods, there just is not access. I've looked at broadband penetration levels even in cities and found them at 40% or lower. So, you know, if we're going to all go digital, we first need to decide how are people going to get that information. And as I talk to statewide digital news outlets who are doing a very good job, the editors tell me they constantly worry about how they get the news to the people that really need to use it, who are not connected. If you're not connected, you're basically consigned to your mobile phone as your primary access onto the Internet. And that means you end up seeing news most often on social media or other kind of apps. And so it really limits your experience to even actually access the news and absorb it. So, you know, we've got to address the lack of digital, high-speed digital availability and affordability in many areas, and you know, if we're going to just go totally digital. But by the same token, I would say that many newspapers, especially in small communities, have found that the key to their survival is not only digital, but also print. So whether it's magazines, whether it's weekly, there are several examples of online-only news sites that over the course of 4 or 5 years decided to add a weekly newspaper into the mix because advertisers like it. They reach a new audience and also reinforce their message. And you reach people who may not be as digitally savvy as this young generation. So I think it's too early to dismiss print as gone as a dinosaur. I think we will continue to see a mix. It's just that print will be a smaller portion of how people use and receive information than it was, say, 30 years ago.
That's really interesting. So we're in the midst of the chips falling, aren't we? Kind of waiting to see where they land.
Right, exactly. And I think the other thing I would say to you, too, is what I've seen having done two books on business models. I would say to you the difference between 30 years ago and now is there used to be one dominant business model for most newspapers. And there's not going to be one going forward. There are going to be many. And it's going to depend on three things. One, the demographics of the community. To the owner or the entrepreneur and whether he can understand and meet the needs and expectations of the residents in that community, and three, whether there's available capital to invest, because there is no way to know what the dominant business model is going to be, what the dominant model of delivery is going to be 10 years from now, to say nothing of, even 20 years from now.
Well, Penny, I have about a dozen more questions for you and no time left. So can we come knocking on your door again soon?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would ask everyone who's interested in learning more, they can go to the Local News Initiative at Northwestern. And we have a report called The State of Local News in 2022, which was just published.
All right. Thanks for mentioning that. Penny Abernathy, visiting professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, author of News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive? And you can download a copy of that from our site, es@eku.edu. Thank you, Penny.
Thank you.
Kentucky native Tiffany Williams, now a singer-songwriter in Nashville, just released All Those Days of Drinking Dust, her second album, recorded in Lexington with a host of local musicians, featuring a title track that is an homage to a long line of coal miners in her family. So, Tiffany, you're living in Nashville now, but where's home?
So, yeah, I'm in Nashville, but home is Letcher County, Kentucky. And in Kentucky, we tell where we're from by our counties, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm from Letcher County, Kentucky, and McRoberts specifically.
Oh, boy. Letcher County and McRoberts in particular were really hit hard in this flood, weren't they?
Yeah, they really were. My parents still live there, and I have other family and friends who live there. And I ended up the week after the flood, that weekend, I went up there to check on mom and dad and take some supplies. And it was just, I mean, it was so sad to see just how hard everybody was hit.
Well, you are the daughter, the granddaughter, the great-granddaughter of coal miners, but I've read that the more you introduce yourself that way when you're doing a live show, the more you feel guilty about it. Why is that?
Well, I don't know so much if I feel guilty anymore. I did struggle with it, you know, and that actually gave birth to the title track of the new album. When I was doing self-promotion, I would, you know, you want something interesting and something that's going to hook people right off. And so, you know, something different. So I'm a coal miner's daughter, granddaughter, great-granddaughter would do the trick. And I kind of felt like I was using it, you know, or like it was exploiting what all the hard work that they had done somehow. And I don't, you know, that's maybe a messed up way to look at it, but that's how I felt at the moment. And it caused me to have feelings. And then when a songwriter has feelings, they usually can channel it through song. And so that's what I ended up doing with All Those Days of Drinking Dust.
So let's talk about this new album, recorded at Dwayne Lundy's studio in Lexington. Is that right?
Yes, the Lexington Recording Company.
Well, Dwayne tells me that for him, the making of the album was about emotion and nuance, and he was kind of interested in capturing a cinematic feel. What do you think about that? Could you see these songs supporting a film?
Yeah, I think that several of the songs, they would maybe work well on a soundtrack. And just because of the way that we kind of, I mean, mostly Dwayne, I wanted him that way, but Dwayne was the one who kind of shaped them into what they are.
Well, to take it in that direction, you and Dwayne pulled together a stellar lineup of artists to support the album in the studio. Who's in that lineup?
Jay Tom Nato, who's in Lexington and plays on a bunch of stuff. Justin Craig, who I think is a Lexington native but lives in New York. Grammy-nominated Justin Craig, which Dwayne is now Grammy-nominated as well. And we had Tripp Bratton on percussion. He's from Lexington. And I had Ellie Miller on fiddle and Taylor Shuck on banjo. And then we had Ben Soli from Louisville to play on the sea.
So, as you mentioned earlier, the album is titled All Those Days of Drinking Dust, and the first song in the album bears that title. What's that song about?
Well, like we talked about, you know, being a coal miner's daughter and kind of feeling a little guilty for it. One of the first lines in the song ends with living in a body that has never been brought low by entering the mouth of a mine. So like, I haven't done what they've done, you know, that's kind of the setup for the song. And then the end of the chorus is, I get to claim it, he gets to smother, I'm a coal miner's daughter. And so that kind of gives you the, you know, kind of the bookend, like the beginning and the end of each chorus. It's about like what it's like to grow up in the shadow of coal mining, basically. And the worry of it, and also the tie to the land. The last verse is about that. And the last verse also has a Shakespeare reference from the play As You Like It. So the reference in there is, and so from hour to hour we ripe and ripe, and hour to hour we rot and rot. So in that last verse, I talk about how there's other places you can go. There's other mountains that don't have coal, and so they're not being, you know, mined. And that's not like you can live in the mountains without living in the coal fields, right? So the line is talking about the mountains. It's, but these are the only ones that watched us rot and rot and hold the bones of both our living and our dead. So it just talks about how like we want to be here, even though it's tough, and even though the mining is such a hard thing. It's our home.
Okay, let's listen to a passage of All Those Days of Drinking Dust. Here it is.
I am a coal miner's daughter, proud as the mountain top pines, living in a body that has never been brought low by entering the mouth of.
So there's a passage from All Those Days of Drinking Dust. It's the title song on Tiffany Williams' new album. She's joining us from Nashville. Tiffany, on your website, you mentioned a new Appalachian movement and that it's tangling influences of the past with complex present-day takes on the region, and they are complex and complicated for sure. With the devastating recent flood as context, do you see music and art in general playing an important role in the region's future?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think past, present, future, you know, music has been so important to the culture and to the healing of the region. And I think it always will be. There's so many Kentucky artists and also like since this has happened, since the flooding has happened, everybody's kind of banded together and put on benefits. And when I had my release show, it was a benefit for the flooding in a lot of ways, in just kind of a spiritual, cultural way and in a practical way, you know, just to and to help us heal too. I think it plays a part.
All right, well, that's Tiffany Williams. The new album is All Those Days of Drinking Dust. You can find it on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Prime, just about everywhere. Google it. And we really appreciate your time, Tiffany. Thanks for joining us, and good luck with the album.
Thank you so much, Tom.
According to city government, at least 185 languages are spoken in Lexington: Spanish, Swahili, Arabic, Japanese, Nepalese, French, Mandarin, Kinyarwanda, spoken in Rwanda and Burundi, Korean, Portuguese, the list goes on and on. You can get hints of a city's diversity by its variety of languages and food options, and Lexington has many. But perhaps less obvious are the many styles of music enjoyed and performed among the various international communities that call Lexington and other cities and towns in our region home. We're exploring them from time to time, and our first installment sampled the mariachi music of the Mexican-American community when Berea music instructor Hernara Rascon stopped by with an armload of instruments. Next. Carnatic music, the classical music of South India, performed on a Sunday evening at Base 249 in downtown Lexington. The performance a vivid and interesting reminder of just how diverse Kentucky really is.
My name is Vasundhara Bhaskar. I've lived in Lexington, Kentucky for now about 20 plus years.
Vasu, a certified public accountant with a degree from UK, is an officer of BIOCS, Bluegrass Indo-American Civic Society.
Lexington is a wonderful city, and it's home to a wonderful Indian-American community. Mm-hmm. And I say wonderful in terms of both size and diversity.
Vasu points out to us that India alone has no fewer than 22 official languages, with a lot of variation between regional languages and cultures, many spoken among the people of the Indo-American community of Lexington.
I would also include the cities such as Hazard and Frankfort, Kentucky, which has been home to Indian American families, and people have lived here for 30, 40 plus years.
You know how much we're annoyed by those Kentucky stereotypes? We're not alone.
Sometimes these stereotypes can keep us from understanding that there's more to it, and or even kind of distort the facts in some ways that people then start assuming things when there's so much more.
Vasu is one of two members of the Lexington Indo-American community, a community of people skilled in finance, software development, healthcare, and many other key professions, who stopped by Eastern Standard for a conversation.
So my name is Bhavani Gudlavaletti. I just completed my first year in med school at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, and I'll be entering my second year.
Not only is Bhavani a student of medicine, she also studies and performs Carnatic music. And it turns out that the foundations of the classical music forms of East and West, seemingly so different, are the same.
So in Western music, it's do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, right? So in South Indian music, it's sa, ri, ga, ma, pa, da, ni, sa, sa, ni, da, pa, ma, ga, ri, sa. Same thing.
But we learn that just as there are things about bluegrass music that distinguish it from, say, New Orleans jazz, there are subtle but important distinctions between the classical Carnatic music of southern India and Hindustani music, a form shaped by Persian and Islamic influences in North India. Vasu Bhaskar taps an app on her iPhone, bringing up the drone of a tambura as background for a demonstration of a Carnatic song.
Gum Ganapate namo namo shankari tanaya namo namo gam Ganapate namo namo shankari.
The music of India began influencing Western rock back in 1966 when George Harrison of the Beatles turned up on the doorstep of famed sitar virtuoso Ravi Shankar.
When George Harrison came to me, I didn't know what to think. But I found he really wanted to learn. I never thought our meeting would cause such an explosion, that Indian music would suddenly appear on the pop scene. It's peculiar.
Then, in the mid-70s, came Shakti, a band formed by American guitarist John McLaughlin, Indian violinist El Shankar, percussionist Zakir Hussain, and Viku Vinayakram. Fast forward to today and Derek Trucks. The music of India has found a home away from home in Lexington, Kentucky. Vasu Bhaskar.
Because of Lexington City's vibe, we see that same spirit. So people come together here. Whereas in very big cities, the population is too huge. It's easy for people to form smaller groups or, you know, go off. Here, people do come together. And there are cultural centers where people gather to celebrate festivals. And on music, of course, is a core part of culture. It's that one common factor, that vein that runs across all regions, all people of all languages and backgrounds. So it's music is integral.
The Bluegrass Indo-American Civic Society provides up to 20 college scholarships every year to graduating Kentucky high schoolers from all socioeconomic backgrounds, all ethnicities. Our thanks to Lakshmi Sriramam for assisting us with this, and Vasu Bhaskar and Bhavani Goodlavaletti for sharing a glimpse of the community and culture of Indo-American Kentuckians. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter, which features a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or maybe suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.